I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Dr. Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
Welcome to the show. On this episode, we're going to be speaking with Tessa Nalvin. Tessa is a doctoral student in clinical psychology at the University of Rhode Island. She's about to begin her clinical internship in the trauma and addiction recovery track at the Boston VA in Boston, Massachusetts, and she is the recipient of the 2022 Division 50 DEI Recognition Award. Tessa is going to spend a little bit of time with us today talking about multiracial identities and health disparities, particularly as it pertains to addiction. Tessa will also be looking for postdoc opportunities, particularly in the Boston and New England area, starting in the summer, I think August of 2024. So if anyone's interested in what she talks about today, please reach out to her. Enjoy the show.
Tessa, welcome to the show. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you.
We begin every one of our episodes talking a little bit about our guest's training history. It helps us to get to know you and your expertise and your journey. And so could you tell us a little bit about your training history, please?
Yeah, so I'm actually finishing up my graduate program at University of Rhode Island. I actually already defended my dissertation, and I'm starting my clinical internship at the Boston VA next month.
Fantastic, fantastic. And where did you go to school before University of Rhode Island?
For undergraduate, I was at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, so in the New England area.
The New Nice. England area, right, yeah. We've both spent some time up here, both Noah and I. It's just a wonderful area. We were just talking before the show about how hot it is, actually, in the summer, though. It gets very unbelievably hot with sometimes no air conditioning. But clinical internship, that's exciting. How are you feeling about starting that next month?
I'm excited to start the clinical work, but definitely it'll be a different pace of schedule for me. So that's something I'll have to get used to.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely an adjustment. As Sam, just coming out of it, I didn't do mine that long ago, and I remember it vividly. I think the net of it was very helpful for me from a training perspective for anybody listening out there who has this coming up, right? So this is the equivalent of residency for those who are getting a doctorate in clinical psychology. So it's the capstone clinical experience that happens at the end of your PhD, which is basically a full-time clinical experience where you're doing kind of 40 hours a week in the clinic, work doing therapy assessment and, mm-hmm. and various other didactic experiences, which can be pretty exhausting coming from, you know, switching up between doing research and teaching, which is a totally different pace and just a different kind of like, I think just like a different level of importance on the types of activities that you're engaging in, which can give them weight, right? Like, you know, being the primary contact point for a person's mental health, seeing them through maybe a long-term or a short-term acute issues can be really just a different weight than like whether or not I teach psych 101 okay, right? And so it's a cool time. I learned so much. I'm excited for you, and also you know, it can be a lot, and so be kind to yourself along the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a formative experience and tiring, but awesome. And your track, I think you mentioned, was a trauma and addiction recovery. So positioning you really well to be able to continue to serve people and in the field as well. So excited to see how that goes and to hear how that goes. Today, we're going to have you talk about something pretty specific. So you've been working over the past, you know, the years of your graduate school on some pretty important issues, and specifically sort of racial factors, racial disparities in substance use research and outcomes and treatment, all of that. And really, I mean, it even gets a little bit more narrow than that, with specifically looking at people who are multiracial. And so before we really jump in, I'm just curious, what kind of got you interested in involved in this type of research?
Yeah, I actually have like a specific memory where early on in graduate school, I was working with my mentor, Dr. Nakia Spillane, And we were looking at nationally representative data. So data that really is supposed to be well put together. Some people may be familiar with the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. And so that has tables that break down rates of different substance use and also mental health things by race and ethnicity. And I was looking at those tables with Dr. Spillane, and we saw that multiracial people, so people that are two or more races, had like among the highest rates of almost every illicit substance. So opioid use, methamphetamine use, illicit substance use in a compiled measure. I think they have among the highest rates of alcohol use disorder. So those disparities where it's, you know, problems among multiracial individuals or really high rates compared to almost every other racial and ethnic group in those tables. And it just kind of shocked me as someone who is multiracial myself. I was shocked. I didn't really know this. Even in the addiction literature, I wasn't aware. And so I wanted to learn more about it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think not a lot of people really think about it as evidence a little bit about, you know, kind of how it hit you when you take a look at the tables. As a person who's multiracial myself, right? Like when you say it out loud, I'm like, oh, I can see maybe how that might come to be. But it's not something it really gets talked about a lot about when you think about kind of the historic, you know, health disparities that exist between racial groups. And so maybe you could tell us a little bit about maybe some of the factors that are associated with some of this, you think. What's really going on here?
Well, I think you're exactly right that not a lot of people sort of are aware of this fact, which is why I was shocked, because when you go to like health disparities talks, and people are talking about, or even when you think about stereotypes about substance use, multiracial people are kind of invisible in that mix. People don't really think about multiracial individuals in the substance use world, and yet they're the ones using at the highest rates, and even by a pretty large margin. Like there's significant differences, you know, 50%, 100% higher rates than other groups, the second highest groups in some of these substances. So like really big differences. So to answer your question about risk and protective factors, I actually, my dissertation study was a qualitative study on exactly that, like what is the risk and protective factors related to multiracial substance use. And so I asked people in focus groups, you know, what do you think is going on? And what I found was, you know, there's a lot of factors that are common among any person using drugs or alcohol, and that it might be neighborhood factors, socioeconomic status, mental health type things. But there's also some unique factors that I think are additive or sort of combining together. Things like difficulties with belonging. People talked about not looking like either of their parents, and how that sometimes posed challenges. Like I had a Black participant who talked about having a white mother and how she was close with her mother, but her mother couldn't tell her how to do her hair or how to respond to discrimination. And so I think in face of challenges like discrimination, stress, other things like that, or identity difficulties, people were feeling a lack of support, a lack of belonging, and that led to, you know, potentially an area where substance use might come into play.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally see that, because identity is such a critical thing. And so when, especially in our sort of racialized society, this idea that you don't feel like you maybe fit into one group or another, maybe you sort of always feel like, oh, well, I'm not quite like this. I'm not quite like this. So, so like from there, is it like a coping mechanism? What, how do you know how that leads to drinking, or is that something that needs to be needs to be explored?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's something that I would like to continue down the road with researching. There's actually very little research out there right now on substance use among multiracial individuals. There's no theories that I've found, very few studies. That's why I started with a qualitative study, because, you know, I was like, where do I start? And so I do think it's something in the future I want to look at, but definitely something I think, you know, coping with all of these stressors, Definitely seems like a reason. People also in my focus groups talked about like using drugs to fit in. So they said,
Yeah.
I
Oh,
already feel
yeah.
like I don't fit
Wow.
in everywhere else in my life. So you know what? If these people are using drugs and that's a place where I can fit in, then I'm going to do it so that I have a space where I'm not like the odd one out for one.
Yeah, it's a really great point, right? Like if you think about, teenage years, let's say, where a lot of, experimentation with substance use and initial substance use events kind of begin, right? A lot of that is interesting that it brings together like a collection of folks who are very different in many ways, except for that they all are experimenting with substances, right? Like if I think back about my high school days, I can think of groups of folks that were like, I would have never expected this collection of people based on identity characteristics. So like their background, how they look, the type of music they listen to, the types of experiences that they view as part of core to their identity, whether that's like I was a skater, so I skated a lot, skateboarded in competition and such, right? And like that has a group that in high school takes me too, right? But also like there were other people from very different groups who might have been, cross-cutting. So I can really kind of make sense out of how that would be, something that brings together people, right? And if you're somebody who already doesn't really have kind of a clear group that you can kind of align with, whether that is cultural or racial, right? Then this might be a clear avenue for that, right? And as a person who's multiracial myself, as you noted about yourself, right? Like there's that experience where you're never really enough of either of them, right? And so, I'm Native American and white in my heritage, and so it's like, I present white, and so that's pretty easy. So when I talk to my Native family, right, they're like, I'm like a white dude, right? But I also have a bunch of cultural experiences that are very different than the average white person who doesn't have Native American heritage, right? Which make me have different types of thoughts and experiences, all of which, make it very different. And so I think your work here sounds really critical to helping us understand kind of diverging pathways for young people and then how that develops into adulthood, into substance use, as it relates to trying to fit in, as it relates to trying to understand our cultural heritage and backgrounds. And I really just want to like put some shine on the idea that you started with qualitative work, which is historically not how we start, and just straight up asking folks like, "What is up over here?" Really is so critical and essential, and seems like the obvious step, and oftentimes we step right over that as researchers. And so, I really just want to applaud you for that. Also, it's like terribly challenging work. Doing qualitative work sounds like it's chill, and it is precisely the opposite. And so, just really want to make sure we give you the flowers on that deal, because that's a Herculean effort right there.
Yeah, thank you. I really felt like it was the only first starting point. Like you said, I do think sometimes people skip over it, but I was like, where do I start? All I know is what my thoughts are about what's going on. But I was like, I want to hear from other people. I'm certainly not an expert at this stage in what's going on related to like these health disparities in multiracial individuals and their substance use. So it felt like the only place. And I was fortunate to be able to get a grant, so a training grant, the F31, funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. So thank you to NIDA for that, because they're the ones who supported me and being able to do these focus groups and actually pay my participants and get help with recruitment, because that was also a challenge in the population I'm working with.
Agreed, agreed. So it sounded like you had some themes that popped up. Are there any themes that we haven't talked about that you think were particularly important for us to make sure that our audience hears about?
Yeah, I think that one that you started to touch on that I think is really important is just that struggling with fitting in with any group. Participants talked about that a lot, where, say, for example, someone is like Asian and white, I'll use my examples. Someone said that they didn't have any like groups where they felt like they could just go and just be part of the group and fit in. So in Asian groups, they might say that people just didn't really see them as fitting in. Maybe they felt like they were being imposters, or they felt like other people actually were not including them in the groups. But then in a white space, they also felt like they were easily identifiable as non-white. And so I think that that was something that was really notable because, on the other hand, a lot of people talked about how multiracial was the identity that they felt they fit in with most.
Yeah.
They felt like, even if you're a mixed race, some other combination, I feel like I relate to you more than either Asian or white people because you have this understanding of how I live in the world. You know, if we think of race as a social construct, the social construction of race means that people, you know, are living in the world based off of how they're perceived by others and
Yeah.
how they sort of fit in with their environment. And so in that way, I think multiracial is a very real race on its own
Yes.
because it's just about how people are finding a way to fit in the world and live in the world.
It's really compelling, and it even highlights even more, you know, how much of an issue it is that there's, you know, and I imagine when you looked at that the NSDA data,
Yeah.
that those cell sizes were really small as well, that there just
Yeah.
weren't that many people that, you know, fell into to the category. And so I've been trying to sort of think through in my mind since we started this discussion, papers that I'm aware of that have explored multi, you know, substance use in multiracial populations kind of exclusively. I cannot think of a single one. And this point that it's a very, I think, unique perspective. And, you know, I think I imagine that people in our data sets, sometimes because they're forced to select one, people are more often multiracial than we even know.
Well, interesting fact related to that, the census, this in people doing multiracial research really are remarking on this, but in the 2010 census, there was 2.9% multiracial. Going back 20 years before that, we didn't even collect two or more races, so not
Wow.
that long ago.
Jeez.
In the 2020 census, they now found that multiracial individuals are 10%, over 10% of the population. So I'm not sure if there's some measurement issues there because it is a little bit like they did ask race in a slightly different way in 2020 compared to 2010, but it's like huge. It's a huge difference and it's a hugely growing population, a
Sure.
young population, and it's something that like shouldn't be as ignored as it is.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think there's a mixture of factors here that are probably contributing to these differences. One of which is definitely how we're asking the questions,
yeah.
Right? Like if you just think back not that long ago, like when I first started graduate school, which isn't that long ago, it was in 2012, right? So it's like right after the 2010 census, like NIH gave how they wanted you to ask the question. And,
yeah, right.
And it had specific categories in there, none of which were multiracial, right? And so, you know, And depending on which investigator and how they collected it, it might be a select one option, right? So you have
right.
to pick an identity that you most identify with. And then other people, right after that, I think kind of change it to like a check all that apply.
Right. Right.
And then it's like, how do they report those issues, those proportions? And so, you know, a lot of times they'll,
Which everyone seems to do differently.
Yeah,
I
that's
feel
my
like.
Point. Yeah,
yeah,
like everybody does it differently. I've seen a bunch of people who just say like, how many different percents get checked, right? But they don't like.
But
also
it's like
pull
over
over.
100%, right?
Yeah, it's
yeah.
over
100%
every time, right? Or like
right.
some people will then like, you know, have a multiracial category on there, so people will check that alone. Or do people generate a multiracial category by looking if you checked
Sure.
two or more boxes? Almost none of that information is described in any participant section of any paper I've ever read. And then they just like blow past it, right? And then they just like keep moving on. And so I think part of it is this, right? And then I think also, you know, we live in an increasingly diverse society, I think, where, you know, segregation and issues like this are still very prominently fixated in the communities we live in, and you know, things are changing in some meaningful ways, which are contributing maybe to more or less of these issues showing up in the way that depending on how we ask them, right? And so I think there's a lot of work to be done here, clearly. And so I really think it's such an important area of research, and I really, as a you know, multiracial person, I really do identify with this theme that you referenced, where like I feel the most like seen by other people who have had this, regardless of what combinations we're talking about, right? Just the idea that you have to like negotiate between multiple like sets of cultural expectations didn't really have like a lane in, depending on where you lived and what was going on in your background, I think is really important. And it also kind of lines up in part with some of the work that we're doing here at Colorado State with the Our Youth, Our Future study, which I know you're familiar with a bit. And I'm working on a paper right now where we look at, you know, proportion of different kinds of student identities in schools and how that may or may not be related to how people are feeling and what they're doing. And there we found that schools that had a greater proportion of students that identified as Native American had some of the better outcomes. So more people that look like me had some of the better outcomes.
Yeah.
And then also we found there that schools that had a greater proportion of students who did not live on the reservation directly had better outcomes. And that's partially because Native American reservations are historically, kind of marginalized communities that don't have a lot of resources and things like that. So students with different experiences, but also look similar in ways that allow them to unify their experiences, they had better positive affect, less negative affect. So they felt better generally. And then they also had differences in their substance use rates specifically. And so I can see how some of this stuff kind of like, we're starting to cobble together a little bit of a picture here about what's going on, but there's still so much work that needs to be done.
Yeah. Yeah. And this makes me wonder, Tessa, I'm not sure if you have any specific recommendations, but this conversation has me wondering, like, well, what is, you know, if there was an ideal way, if we could get the whole field to agree on how to ask about this particular question in research, what do you think that would be?
That's a great question. It's something I do actually have a lot of thoughts on, because on one side, I understand that like when we want to do like quantitative analyses, so analyses with, numbers, if we want to look at things like race, we do by nature have to put people into groups in order to limit the analyses. Like an ideal way to ask people about race is an open-ended question saying, how do you identify? But then we could have like 100 things and then you can't do an analysis with 100 different answers. So on one side, I see the fact that we do have to categorize people. And on the other side, I like think that the number of categories we have is too limited right now. So I do see sometimes people say like select all that apply. What I've done in my research is ask people to select all that apply, but then also ask for forced choice so that instead of the researchers then putting people into categories later based off of what they want to do, I can say which identity do you primarily identify with, or which race? And I like to include like Hispanic as a racial option if people choose to put that. I put multiracial as a racial option. I put all the other main categories, and then I also think that gives like I think it was like 90% of the participants in is small sample, but in my multiracial study said they primarily identify as multiracial, but there were a couple who said, you know, I'm actually living in this world as a white person. I do have multiracial background, but I'm living in this world as a white person, or I'm living in this world as a black person. So they got to pick and say like where they primarily identify.
It's really interesting too. Yeah. I wonder what kind of factors, you know, and there might be a connection with substance use, but I think this goes even beyond that more specific area. Like what factors kind of influence that choice?
Yeah. And I think, you know, things like skin tone, who you're raised by, the family you're closest with, the family that was kindest to you, sorts of things like that can influence it.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And this brings up to me, and I've been talking with researchers, you know, as part of trying to kind of modernize some of the Our Youth, Our Future questions as it relates to identity characteristics, you know, and about like sex and gender, for instance, right? Like this has a similar kind of set of barriers and facilitators and differences along a continuum. And, you know, one of the things that they've been talking about there is kind of similar to what you're talking about here. And then they added like additional information for the participant. So it said like, check all that apply, you know, and provide as many of those things, and then have another forced choice question and say, research necessitates us placing people in categories. What category would you like us to place you in for research purposes?
Is
kind of how they recommended it when you're talking about like sex and gender. And I think it follows here a similar line, right? Like, and I think it's a kind of like implicitly, and maybe we could say it even more explicitly, like you're saying, right? Like, which one of these do you most identify with, and what category would you like us to place you in? Because that will allow us to, right? It's the way I like to think about race and ethnicity, in part, is it's not necessarily what you are as much as what your relationship with it is. Right. And that's kind of what this is getting at, right? Like, a person who lives in the world is a white person who's white passing, even though they may have, you know, multiracial background, right? Like,
yeah,
that person, probably their data probably are most likely going to align with, you know, this white category or whatever we're putting in there. So placing them there would make sense. And so I wonder, you know, if we can't, wonder is probably overly generous. I'm convinced that doing a better job of this is essential. And I wonder how we can get more people to do that, right? Like, right. And I think, you know, having really, you know, federally funded studies, quality studies like yours are like just the obvious and necessary first steps to getting us there. And then putting together compelling work, you know, about how to do this is probably the big next steps, if that makes sense.
Definitely. I think that more people are becoming aware of the non-binary, like gender and sex, which has historically been dominated in demographic questionnaires. I don't think that a lot of people are there with race yet. And it is sort of, you know, a thorn in my side, because, you know, I'm like, race isn't a select one. I got hired at a large national institution recently, and I was forced to choose one race still. And I was like, how do I pick one when I'm 50-50 still?
Wow.
So it's like, you know, it's just not there yet. And, you know, I'm glad that it is happening with sex and gender. I'd love to see more people paying attention to that with race.
Yeah, that's, it's disappointing to hear that that's true. And it, you know, things move slowly. And like you're saying, I mean, it sounds like you're doing maybe the only work right now, and at least substance use. I'm sure there's a lot of other people, but I mean, you're doing some of the you're at the front end, right? Of this journey. And it's kind of exciting. Based on your qualitative study and your findings, like, what are the next important steps?
Yeah. Well, I just want to say also, there are some incredible researchers out there doing the work right now, in addition to me. But it feels like we're few and far between. So to that point, yes. You know, next steps, I would love to see, you know, I would love to see more researchers doing this type of research, because it feels like there's so many ways to go. One of the things that I know a lot of people that do research with minoritized populations have to do is start looking at measurement, and, you know, the fact that a lot of measures that are out there are designed, or like, were made primarily initially with primarily white young populations. And so, you know, are we asking the questions in the right way? So that's sort of a next step. And then looking at, like, you know, what are the mechanisms behind the substance use? And then, of course, ultimately down the road, my ultimate goal is to develop interventions specifically for substance use, but, you know, mental health in general, to help like marginalized populations such as people that are multiracial.
Yeah, you make me think of like measurement invariance studies that would be like really important. Yeah.
And I know people in your group and at URI are doing work like this, right? Like, I just saw a talk from Sylvie Goldstein. Shout out Sylvie, who was doing measurement invariance of, like, you know, consequences or something like this across different groups and stuff. And like, that work is really hard, right? And so that's like a statistical way of testing whether or not different kinds of people or different time points cause people to answer the same questions differently. Right. And so you can look at, you know, invariance across groups. So, like, you know, do people who are multiracial answer these questions differently than people who are, you know, primarily one race or group, right? Or people who use substances, or older folks, right, versus younger folks, and all these types of things. And I think that's like really heady statistical stuff, because it's challenging to accomplish, but like, absolutely core to what we do and doesn't get done enough. And so I think your point here is really a good one. I think we do that better, and that's probably being generous when we think about like assessment approaches, right? So maybe things like intelligence or psychodiagnostic testing, like people talk about it a lot. I don't think our measures do a good job at accommodating these differences, but at least people talk about it. But in, I think, just like run-of-the-mill published empirical research, basically people know, but even reference that in their measure section, right? So in the measure section, it says, here's the thing we did, and here's why it's good for the people we gave it to. And nobody says it exhibits measurement invariance across racial or identity categories, right? Nobody says that. They say like, oh, it had a good alpha score, which basically means that the items together are similar.
Yeah.
And so I think that's such a huge, I think, area of work that needs to be done. And then I think really understanding, these risk and protective factors like you're talking about, and how can we fold in these insights that you're learning from people's lived experience and company with, large scale, nationally representative research potentially on how to, really help a person make the types of changes that they're looking for, whether that's related to their substance use or more broadly to their life. In ways that support their unique set of identity characteristics and cultural backgrounds, if that makes sense. And we all obviously have a long way to go there too. And so the path ahead is a long one, and just absolutely essential. And so I really just want to applaud you for doing this work and bringing, highlighting these issues both to my attention personally and also to our audience.
Yeah, thank you for having me talk about these things because I obviously am very passionate about it.
We had the opportunity to have you on the show. We were like, we got to make this work so we can have you on to talk about these issues because nobody's really talking about them. And so just really think it's absolutely essential.
Yeah, there's some papers on multiracial invisibility. And so the concept basically is that sort of what we started the conversation with, nobody even, not that many people are aware that multiracial people have these vast health disparities. Even, people that maybe identify as multiracial aren't aware. And so I think that, I would just love the word to be out there more. I actually was looking earlier this morning at those National Survey on Drug Use and Health tables this morning, and just to refresh my mind. And it actually started to get me upset looking at not just the substance use stuff, but also mental health concerns. So there was also like multiracial individuals were the highest for any mental illness in the past year for any. For serious mental illness. And again, not by small margins, by huge margins. I didn't do an analysis, but it was like, maybe 50, 100% higher than the second highest racial group again. On thoughts of suicide, on, on thoughts of suicide, suicidal behaviors. And so that, it hurts me to see that. Even when we think about like academic curricula, talks on health disparities, thinking about substance use and where people are including, what racial groups people are including in their research or how they even ask about race, those things are like so important to me. And I really wish, the field and everyone was paying more attention to a group that seems to be, at least a portion of people are really struggling.
Your point here is a really good one. I think just quickly, if we can, right? Like if you think about, suicidal thinking and things like that really jumps off the page, as you noted. And right, some of the most prominent theories around why people experience suicidal thinking is like oriented a little bit around a belonging and feeling, apart from others. Right. Some of it's about, feeling like a burden to people that you're with, but there's other parts of it that are about, feeling a sense of belonging and a lack of kind of connectedness to others. And so, if we connect the dots, while obviously theoretical in our exercise here, right, that like people who have multiracial identities don't fit in normal kind of categories that present themselves in day-to-day life, unless they have some kind of group of
Yeah.
multiracial people in their lives, which is like, as a multiracial person, I don't know of such groups, but maybe they exist out there, right? But it's easy for you to imagine a scenario where that sense of belonging that you talked about as a theme in your qualitative work showing up as a risk factor across multiple areas of a person's mental health. Substance use gives you an avenue to belong, but presents risk, right? It's not risk-free, right? And then, you know, or it could, you know, show up in other forms of mental health concerns like depression, anxiety, and ultimately things like suicidal thinking and suicide rates, probably more broadly. And so I think, you know, a lot of work needs to be done here in connecting the dots between these issues and highlighting them is such essential first step in that.
That reminds me that another thing I asked and made a point to ask about is protective factors, because, you know, I think the field in general is moving towards these marginalized groups and how we want to look at protective factors as well. I do a lot of work on Indigenous populations with my mentor. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot is culture is healing. And that's another area, where, again, with multiracial individuals, like when I asked about protective factors, a few of my focus groups had some thoughts on like how they felt more emotionally and socially intelligent than other people, because they said, I'm always trying to figure
out
where and how I fit in. But something that didn't come up is culture as a healing and protective factor, which is such a great thing for other populations. But I think that's something that multiracial individuals don't sort of have. And not that they couldn't, but that there aren't these multiracial groups, like you mentioned, yet, where they're getting a sense of culture and identity and community that other minoritized groups at least have, that helps them respond to all of the other negative aspects of society.
Yeah. So do you think that creating spaces you could call it an intervention for substance use, but even just in general, like creating like a space where people who identify as multiracial can come together and just talk about, like, and I even wonder about if anyone gave you feedback during these sessions, like about like what it was like to come and talk about their identity.
Yeah. Unprompted. I didn't ask about it, but a few people in my focus groups were like, this focus group like makes me feel so heard just that you're asking the questions. Cause not that many people are doing that yet. I also had people saying like, oh, like institutions, like colleges, communities, they should be making multiracial groups, especially if we're saying it's 10% of the population now, according to the 2020 census. That's not a small group of people. 10% of the population.
Not at all. Yeah.
Big. And right. And why aren't there? Like when I try to Google multiracial groups, there's few.
Yeah. That's like 30 million people in the U.S. alone. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Right. Like there's like in the neighborhood of 300 to 350 million people, right?
In
the U.S. alone. It's like 30 million people you're talking about in the U.S., which that's like a massive number of folks who have to pick a lane when they exist already in a space that if we provided them more connection to those that also share that space, that it might be able to really, I think, produce in them. And that's like one of the things that we think about when we think about, you know, working with folks who, you know, come from marginalized communities, is trying to find spaces where they can connect with people that are like them, who've had similar experiences and maybe, you know, may adopted you know, specific approaches to living their life that have been helpful. You know, addiction recovery has, you know, many spaces like this. AA is one of them, but there's many of them. But also, you know, support groups for people who identify, you know, as a sexual minority, for instance, or LGBTQ, and all these different types of factors. And so I think providing more spaces is probably like, it's like a super obvious next step that needs to exist. And I think highlighting how big of a group this is, the types of experiences that they're having, that are challenging, but also shout out to your bringing us back to the protective factors, because I do think that is something when we talk about health disparities more broadly that we almost never speak on, right? And like it's always like, oh, culture, also, right? So it's like it's obviously culture, but there's a host of other things that could be happening in this space that we just don't know, especially when we're talking about people who hold identities that cross multiple cultures, right? And so a lot of work needs to be done here. And I think, you know, just want to thank you for doing the hard work that it takes to do this type of work. And also shout out to your participants whose bravery to share their experiences with you allowed us to understand these things better.
Yeah, I second that. I am nothing without my participants.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we get lost in that a lot. I try to put a shout out in my talks these days to the participants. And I think especially folks who haven't been historically heard or seen, and become invisible, as you noted here, I think especially need to get shouted out and right. And to remember, you know, our work is a lot about numbers and things like this. And, you know, people aren't math equations to be solved, right? They're sunsets to be appreciated, as the famous line from Kelly Wilson goes. And I really try to hold that to be true, especially when we're talking about people who have been historically considered invisible.
Yeah, that invisibility quote you had kind of has been ringing in my mind. It made me think of the concept of terminal uniqueness, which is, you know, something that I think is common in like recovery spaces, but it's also used in other things as well. And the idea is that there is this part of you that feels like you're the only one who's having this experience. And when people aren't, you know, when you go to fill out a form, and how you identify isn't on that. It cannot help but reinforce that feeling, and maybe even keep someone from speaking up and talking about their experience and from finding out that they're not quite alone. What you're doing, Tessa, and hopefully through people who are listening to this, just hearing you, maybe is part of the steps to, you know, give voice to this population.
Agreed.
Yeah, I hope so. And I'm trying to get some papers out there that are saying, you know, these messages. You know, it's not always been very successful lately, but I am trying.
Yeah, I hear that on numerous levels, right? The paper game is a special brand of activity. Right, which requires tolerance.
Right. But there's just different types of dissemination, and that's an important one, right? Absolutely.
Yes.
But work in this space, work on social media, and just being a voice. Yeah, like you're given opportunities to be heard, and so I just appreciate so much like how you choose to use that voice, and so. I'm sure that the other successes will come. Qualitative research is comes with its own brand of difficulty in our field. And I think there's a growing respect for that, which I think is incredibly important, especially, and I think in our field of addiction, you know, with incorporating lived experience more often, than has been in the past. But, so I'm sure that will come, but I appreciate the other ways that you do it too, Tessa.
Right. No, that's such a good point that qualitative in and of itself, people have like, you know, little understanding of, little knowledge of, or little respect for sometimes, unfortunately. And therefore, right, like a qualitative paper is not going to be, you know, considered as rigorous, unfortunately, in some areas. And then also, I think that's compounded by the fact that the multiracial invisibility, people aren't aware of how big of an issue the substance use in multiracial individuals is yet. So even among like addiction, you know, journals and, you know, in the addiction field, I think that people aren't like, oh my God, this is so important yet. So hopefully, you know, and thanks to hopefully this podcast, more people will be aware of that.
Completely agree. Yeah. Shout out to qualitative researchers who do the hard work. Most of the stuff I do, I press like buttons, and then like numbers come out, and then I get to make sense out of them. Whereas taking, you know, numerous transcripts of folks and then trying to create thematic connections between folks is just such.
And then sometimes after a decade of research, quantitative research, we realize, oh, we have not been, you know, asking the right question. This data doesn't actually quite make sense given what people actually experience. So.
Exactly.
To do it on the front end, Tessa. So,
agreed.
Well, thank you.
Also, shout out, I think, to you just to coming on to the show, and speaking about these issues. I think takes bravery of its own, and so we just want to make sure that we thank you for coming on the show, because this is a really important issue that we haven't talked at all about on the show, and many of our audience members will probably never even heard of. And so bringing this to the foreground, or to the forefront, is just really important. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. It was basically get a soapbox to talk about the things I want to talk about. And that's really cool. So thank you for giving me that.
Oh, of course. Yeah. It's always nice to have an opportunity. I feel like we get so into our spaces and we get excited about it, but like sometimes it can feel like we're kind of in the corner of our own room on our own soapbox. So it's always fun when we get to talk about this kind of stuff together, the stuff that we care about. So happy to have you and really glad. It's a very important topic. So is there anything else that you wanted to address before we moved on to the take homes?
I think that's all.
Great. As our listeners probably know, and as we sort of discussed, these are brief, you know, 30 seconds to a minute. Sometimes we end up having conversations around them, but intended to just be brief take-home messages for stakeholders. It can summarize a lot of the things that we've already discussed. And if you have sort of new points that come up, those are welcome here as well. So, but first one, what do you think the take-home message is from your work for people who are in recovery or who might be interested in making a change to their substance use, and maybe particularly among the people who identify as multiracial?
Well, I think it actually reminds me a lot of that term you used earlier, and I'm forgetting, was it perpetual uniqueness?
Terminal uniqueness.
Yeah. So I think multiracial people are most likely especially susceptible to that. And, you know, my message would just be that, like, you're not alone. A lot of people might be experiencing similar things. You may be 10% of the population. There's many other people out there that may have parallel experiences. And, you know, there are people like me and many other researchers out there that are working to change this and to help and to reduce these disparities.
Yeah. What would you say the take-home message is to practitioners?
To practitioners, I would just ask that, you know, they practice cultural competence, cultural humility, and that they include multiracial people in their self-education when they're reading literature reviews or, you know, doing research. But, you know, that they are, you know, including a knowledge of multiracial individuals and some of the challenges they might be experiencing so that they can validate multiracial individuals that come to them and help with some of the unique experiences they might be facing.
Yeah, that's great. Take home messages for policymakers.
I mean, ideally, I think for policymakers, I would love to see an allocation of resources towards multiracial individuals, you know, through social groups, community groups, college groups. I would love to see more of that in general.
Yeah, that sounds, and it sounds like maybe make sure demographic surveys reflect.
Yeah. Too, definitely. Right. Think about, spend a lot of time thinking about your demographic questions before, because that's big. And also, you know, ask other people, you know, how should I ask this if you're not sure yourself? Yeah. Because some people have spent a lot of time thinking about how to ask their demographics.
Yeah. I've had personally very rich conversations, as I noted,
right,
that really changed the way that I ask it in some of our studies, if that makes sense. And I know we've talked a lot about this last point a little bit, but just to make sure that it's clear for our audience, what do you think the take-home message is for underserved populations?
Well, I think that things like discrimination, environment, you know, have deleterious negative effects. But I also think that for like any underserved population, you can't compare negative experiences and say mine is worse or better. And I think that happens to multiracial individuals a lot, that they're being told their negative experiences aren't as negative as other people whose negative experiences. And that that's creating this space where they're getting even further marginalized than other groups, despite maybe having some white privilege or lighter skin than others. And so, you know, I would just say try to be inclusive. Marginalized populations, underserved populations are struggling. Discrimination is, you know, has such negative effects. But, you know, try to be inclusive of multiracial people and support, you know, their space as well.
Great point. Great point.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that point too, Tessa. Well, this has been fantastic. I think very illuminating episode. We have one last question for you. You've been really successful in a relatively short time frame so far. And you're sort of positioned to be an expert on these issues and just, you know, to sort of lead our field. I'm wondering if you have any advice for people who are sort of coming up behind you.
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. I would say that my advice is actually almost to myself still at this point, where just know you deserve to be where you are. You know, there's constant comparisons to others. What is success? You know, my initial thought was like, no. And then I was like, wait, this is exactly what my advice
Yeah.
would be, is don't say no. Don't attribute your success to good luck. Know that you worked hard to get to where you are. Anyone in like a trainee space in higher education, in addiction, like, you know, medical or social science fields, worked hard to get into that higher education space. So own that.
Completely agree.
I love that, Tessa. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to chat with us about these important issues. And it's just been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Thanks, Tessa.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.